Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 43. Today on the show, I have Derek Evely, Canadian track and field coach. Here's a little bit of what we're going to get into on the show today.
If you want to peak more often and do shorter cycles, you can do that with the sprints, but you're going to have to limit the number of sprint abilities that you target. So you may only be able to do acceleration, max velocity, or acceleration and special endurance or something in one development cycle.
Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right. Hey, welcome to episode 43 of the podcast. Thanks for being with us today. I'm your host, Joel Smith. And today, if you hadn't noticed already, we have a periodization and planning expert, Derek Evely, on the show. He's a Canadian track and field coach. He's very well versed in the Bondarchuk training system, but not only a coach of the throws, but has also experienced coaching every other event in track and field, including cross country, which is so cool. It's just, I love talking with people who have experienced the wide range of athletes and energy systems and training methodologies within. This podcast is definitely one for those of you who would consider yourself a little bit of a periodization, planning, and organization nerd. Maybe not nerd, but just enthusiast, if you will. If you're a coach or even an athlete, there's going to come a time where just having good exercises is probably not going to help anymore. You have to have some sort of system and way of organizing training. And that's, to be completely honest, the exercises, I feel like that's the easy part. Planning things and finding what exercises work and when and how long can you use them and observing trends and finding individualization, that's the hard part. I really can't think of too many experts who have the wealth of knowledge that Derek does in that arena. And to be completely honest, even listening to a podcast is great, but planning and knowing how to do it well is something that it takes a lot of experience and trial and error. And we definitely learn so much better from hearing these anecdotes and stories from people who have had that experience than reading a textbook. And that's why I love to have people like Derek on the show. We are going to be talking a lot about the Bondarchuk system, which I'm going to explain in a minute to the best of my non-throws coach ability. And we're going to talk about that system and its ideals and philosophies in context of working with a lot of other events that I know a lot of viewers of the show are very interested in, say, sprinting faster, or even within the scope of track and field or physical preparation, the jumps and other speed and power outlets. So how do I take this this Bondarchuk training system, which swept the medals in hammer throw at Olympics for so many years and produced a ton of great throwers and allowed a lot of throwers who had been stagnating on other traditional training programs or like cycled and wave loaded and did a lot of max strength and got those throwers to get to PR levels. How do we take this system and give it context into all the other stuff? And that's the tricky part, but I think that you're going to learn a lot by listening to Derek on the show with that in mind. So before I get any farther, I'm going to do my best to explain the Anatoly Bondarchuk training system. So the main premises behind the system, I'm just going to go into two things. The first is the exercise selection. Most of the exercise selection of the system revolves around the competitive exercise, or CE. So that's basically your sport. Okay, so if you're a shot put thrower, it's the shot put. If you're a high jumper, it's the high jump. If you're a sprinter, it's sprinting, particularly your race distance. And then the training is triaged into three other classifications, special developmental, special preparatory, and general preparatory exercises. It might be special or specific on those middle two. I hope I didn't butcher it. But it basically goes down in order, or down the hill, if you will, in order of specificity and thus transfer. So exercise classification, and that's probably something that's very directly transferable and useful to all avenues of training, more so than even the hammer throw or the throws, because it's good to know what has transferred to what you're trying to do and at what point should we be looking to not just try to max out in the weight room. At what point does the weight room not offer yield, and when do we need to look at other modes of exercise as primary importance? So there's that. And then secondly, and this is going to really be important for what Derek and I are talking about today, and it's the periodization model. I wouldn't even call it periodization. It's just the organization. And for simplicity's sake, I mean, you can have one, two, or three workouts, but many times the bonded tuck system or model is carried out with one workout. So you do the same workout every day. And let's say you're a shot putter, and you're going to measure how far you throw the shot put every day to test how you're doing as you go along. And you're obviously going to have exercises from the other categories in there as well. And you're going to do that workout for as many sessions as it takes before you reach a peak. So you will reach a peak. Some people go actually down before they go up and hit that peak. But basically, there'll be a few sessions where you're at a very high level, and then you'll really start to drop off. And the number of sessions that it took before you drop off is the basically the length of your reaction. So it could be anywhere from, I don't know the exact numbers, 20 to 40 is often a number that's given. So that took that many sessions or touches before you adapted. But the system, it's and Derek's going to explain as well in this regard, but it's not waived. It's not, I'm going to do 3 weeks of increasing intensity, and I'm going to take a week down, and I might change some exercises. And there's a lot of different types of workouts in there. And in the Bondarchuk model, there can be two or three. But generally speaking, you're doing the same thing every day until you tap out. And at that point, you're going to go into a little bit of a rest or a cleanse cycle, and then change all the exercises and go again. So very different than traditional methods. Very, very individualized. It helps you determine the individual nature of how that program is going to affect the athlete. So hopefully I did a good job. Hopefully all you throws coaches out there and sports scientists aren't too mad at me if I butchered that off the cuff there. I think that's a fair description of the system. And with that said, let's get on to talking on how that system, principles from the system, and just general ideas can filter into all manners of speed and power training, specifically sprinting, but a lot of other things as well. So episode 43 of the Just Fly Performance Podcast with Derek Evely. All right, Derek, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome, man. So to start it all off, I know a lot of people listening are probably familiar with your background and your work, but could you give us a quick background of how you got into the coaching field, where you've been, and where you are now?
Well, I got into the coaching field like many of my colleagues that, you know, just they were pretty crappy athletes, and but they loved the sport. And so it was just a natural progression to go into coaching. And I started out as a decathlete. I started out as a young athlete doing all the events, and then formalized that as a decathlete, trained at a national training center in Canada. I was sort of the low man on the totem pole there. That led to my first professional coaching job in Kamloops, where I had a number of, very small isolated community up in the mountains of Canada here. Had some decent success with some athletes who were successful under my charge, but also went on under other elite coaches to win, you know, some Olympic medals, world champ medals. And then from there, ended up in the Canadian Athletics Coaching Center, where I just spent 4 years sort of studying a lot of theory and methodology, which is a passion of mine. Oh, and of course, that's where I met Bonnerchuk, was in that club setting. And excuse me, he, you know, for the last year I was there, him and I worked together. He lived in my basement. We wrote a book and the whole bit, right? Then I was in Edmonton. Then from Edmonton, I got a job, followed Kevin Tyler to the UK, worked for UK Athletics as a center director there for about almost 4 years, going into the 2012 Olympics. And then after that, decided to come back to Kamloops to raise my young family. And that's where I've been ever since. And so now I do a lot of this kind of work. You know, a lot of coach development work, and currently I'm coaching in China. I have a 6 month contract in China coaching a discus thrower over there. So, you know, I just sort of, these days I'm sort of bouncing around coaching where I can, and but doing a lot of this type of work, which I enjoy.
Well, that's awesome, man. And I had heard before that you were a decathlete as an athlete, but you're most certainly most well known for the throws, I believe. Have you get into that throws arena right away? Like, or did you spend time coaching the other events as well?
I've coached all the events. I've even coached cross country, but at a high level, sprints and throws are what I've coached mostly. Dabbled around with some decathletes here and there and stuff like that, but I've never really been in a position to really put a really good program together, other than for sprints when I was in Edmonton, because we had Kevin had a really good setup there, and then the throws back in back here in British Columbia, because it's pretty much the only event group that you could coach at a high level year round. And even there, it was difficult. I was coaching in my backyard. I had a 10 acres and I built a training facility there, but you know, we were throwing in minus 30 and in the winter and stuff like that, so it was difficult. But my passion is definitely the throws. I love the throws, always have. I started out as a discus thrower as a young kid, and then of course, you know, my relationship with Bonnerchuk was a natural one because of our affinity for the throws, the two of us. So I've always gravitated to it, but I love coaching the other events as well. I've always sort of, and I say this to all development coaches, coach the athlete, not the event. So when they come to you, you will be far more successful if you try not to take every athlete that comes to you and fit them into your event group, but coach them what they're going to be good at. You'll have way more success. It's a lot more learning. It's a lot more it's a lot more work, but it's also, you know, you'll get far more success with that. And that was always my philosophy when I was in Kamloops for those 11 years. And there, you know, hence I had a world-class 400 meter runner, a world-class middle distance runner, and a world-class thrower come out of that program, you know, pretty distinct events. So,
yeah, though, that's awesome, Derek. Yeah, I like what you said there about coaching the athlete and not the event. And I suppose in light of probably especially what you've learned through some of the Bonnerchuk principles too, which we'll talk about, I'm sure that makes even more sense.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So let's get to that first kind of official methodology question. What's your take on how some principles from the Bonnerchuk model can spill over into traditional programming? And I'll cover the Bonnerchuk model in the pre-roll, but if you want to talk, you can talk about it briefly too. I know it's a simple program with that's really complex in real life once you actually get into it, but how does that model, or what are some takeaways on how that model can spill over to those of us who are doing the traditional cycles and training?
Well, a couple things I want to say at the beginning here. First of all, I don't speak for Bonnerchuk. I always start these things saying that. I am probably the one guy around that is the most familiar with it, and that's why I do a lot of these things. Myself, Bingisser, and Garcia, you know, are the three guys that seem to have, in my assessment, have implemented it the best. Garcia in particular, he does a really good job down in Southern California there. He really gets it. But I have a big background in theory and methodology. So, it's I've always been able to put it into that context, I think. I don't, you know, I do the best I can with that system. It's such an individualized, nuanced system that it really, it can be difficult to implement. It's simple in its form, but it can be difficult. And I don't pretend to say that I know everything about it, all the ins and outs, but I have been able to make it work. I've had good success with it, and I've had good success with it in terms of, when you look, we'll probably talk about the athlete reactions. Like when you start getting consistent, regular reactions like that, then you know you're doing it right. So in that sense, it's good. But there's, he has the way he implements it himself is so nuanced. It's just really, I think what's happening right now with Kibwe's using it as well. And there's a coach in Australia that is doing a phenomenal job. The coach is their top shot putter. He's doing an incredible job with it. He's another guy that has implemented this really, really well. I think with all those guys doing the program and out there, I think the program is going to sort of evolve into its own, going off, and all these coaches are going to evolve their own ways of doing it, which I think is a very good thing. The thing that's interesting about it is this speaks to your question. It is so radically different in some ways from traditional methodology that, I don't speak about it saying in terms of this is what you should be doing, because it's a system like any other system. There are good systems, there are bad systems. There are lots of great traditional systems out there. And I don't use the word traditional in any negative way. I'm saying there are a lot of the systems, I call them traditional systems, like something that, say, Dan uses, right? Which is a very modern system, but I have no other word for it. It's non-Bondarchuk system, I guess, is what you could say. They all work really well. I'm not saying, and this is why I really, when I was reviewing your questions for this, I really like your questions, because you get to the heart of it here is I'm not saying here you should be doing this system. I'm saying, look at, if you want to do this system, it is very effective, but there are some certain rules you have to stick to. But there are really interesting parts about this system that I think can really help people in any type of training or methodology. There are things that we traditionally haven't considered before. And so I'd say the first point of that is the non-wave loading and volume and intensity, which is the hardest element of this to get your head around for a lot of traditional coaches that have not used this system. And that is the idea that when you present a stimulus to the athlete, by stimulus, I'll say workout, I'll say session, I'll say whatever, it's all the same thing. When you present a workout, a unit of training to an athlete, in this system, you can't change it. You have to keep repeating it over and over. They do the same workout day in and day out. You may have a number of those, two, three, even four of them, I guess, if you wanted to. But there's issues around that as well. Typically we use one, two, or three sessions. You have to keep rolling those over. You have to keep, you can't change. And that, when you do that, and this is my first point here, when you stick to that and you adhere to it strictly, you start to see that athletes have a very regular response to training, which you will not see doing anything else. Okay, I'm not saying it's better, I'm not saying it's worse. I'm saying it's interesting, and it's something to think about, because the first thing I took away from it when I started using this system was, wow, I never really thought about how much change I had in the system and how in my previous training systems and how that was affecting the athlete. I'm not saying it's bad to change things. It's good to change things. You need to change things. I'm just, the first thing, where that led me was this question of, well, if I'm just if I'm not considering the nature of the change and the timing of the change, then, you know, even the smallest changes can, you know, will change the reaction of the athlete for better or for worse. So it's something to think about. You know, and then the second thing, which is very much related to that, is just the whole issue of change, using change as a methodological tool in its own right, as opposed to, well, I'm just changing because, you know, I like to cycle things in and out, and, you know, I want to try this, I want to try that. Again, change is powerful, very powerful. And so, and you want to use it to your advantage. And I think it's very important to consider it. And then, the, you know, considering what it's doing to your program, or your athlete's response to training. And then the third thing I'd say is monitoring. Like, when, you know, it is critical to have some kind of monitoring in place. And I know, you know, a lot of old school coaches will just use their eye or use times on the track, which is fine. But somewhere in there, you have to have a monitoring system in place. Doesn't have to be super sophisticated, but A, it has to be there, and B, it has to be as specific as possible, and as regular as possible, because until you have that in place, you really have no idea how the athlete is changing. You may think you do, and you may be right, but I have found using this system that the athlete's response is so accurate, so reliable, and so precise that it just kind of like blew me away a bit. It's like, wow, you can get a very reliable, dependable response from an athlete in training if you follow these simple rules. I'm not saying you have to. I'm not saying you have to do a bonus check system. I'm just saying that you need to think about these things, because until I started doing the system, I didn't realize how powerful they were.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, that's a great answer, Derek. I really like what you said about it. And this is the one that really stuck out to me, is it's the only system that you can really truly see the response of the athlete. And it's like in sports science, we have so much time invested in tracking all these variables and monitoring. But to me, just to be able to take things to the barest of what you need and just do the same thing and see how long it takes to adapt, there's so much in that. I almost feel like that almost... And I know you have experienced it with both of the methods. Like, it seems to me almost if you took an athlete, did that first, and then went into traditional later, you would have a better understanding of them going into the traditional wave loading stuff. In my mind, it seems that way, because you could know, are you a fast adapter, are you slow reaction? Do you think there's connections there? Like, if you had an athlete and what you learned from them in the Bondrew Tuck system, what you might be able to take to wave loading or traditional type work?
Totally. Totally. I think totally. And it's interesting you say that, because Nick Garcia and I have been talking a lot about that lately. I talked a bit about this, and I think in the last podcast I did with Martin, who does a phenomenal job trying to get this information out there, by the way. Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot. I mean, there are some limitations to the system, or at least I haven't figured out some issues with it. And particularly around it, you know, around the maximal strength, which isn't really part of the system per se. It sort of falls under the transfer of training, that which is sort of a component of all of this, not necessarily a factor in the system itself. But I've been thinking lately about looking at long-term patterns and long-term responses of athletes when they switch programs, like, you know, environments and different coaches and things like that, that there may be a, you know, maybe the future in all of this is a blend of something like this, where you go with a traditional program for a while and then use something like a Bondrewczyk system. Because I've seen athletes respond very, very well to the Bondrewczyk system after they come from a non-Bondrewczyk approach. And again, is that because of the content of those two systems? Like, one may be max strength based, one may be, you know, is it the quantitative differences, or is it a qualitative difference? Is it simply the change? I don't have an answer for it. I'm good at noticing trends. It's one of my few assets I have as a coach. I'm very good at it. I don't know why, but I see these things. They just kind of pop out to me, and it's one thing I've been noticing. So if you see this trend over and over again, why don't you take a closer look at it and, you know, and maybe make it part of your overall scheme? You know, maybe it's you want to change your methodology every few years. Maybe you want to change it within an annual cycle. I don't know. It's a discussion that it's a really interesting discussion that I think that's out there for debate. And I've heard Bonnerchuk's told me this. Bonnerchuk has told me himself every 5 years, a coach needs to change his methodology with an athlete because they get just like they. We'll talk about accommodation today, I'm sure, but just as they accommodate in the short term, they accommodate in the long term, and you need to be able to respond to that.
Yeah, that's huge. It that's a lot. I know of what you were talking about on that last part podcast you did with Martin on Hammer Media. It was really good talking about changes and athletes who had switched to another coach and shortly thereafter see personal best, or and it would just take that change in methodology for that to happen.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, you know, our egos and our you know our ways of thinking sometimes get in the way of that. You know, we look at that and go, wow, he switched coaches, that must be a better coach, must be a better program. I don't know. I think maybe it's just the change. Maybe that's all it is, you know. And it's I'm not making any kind of a judgment on the programs either way. I'm just saying that, you know, we don't need to look at it that way. We can look at these changes as just a change. Just, you know, that's it. Maybe that's all that was necessary. And, you know, it's just something to think about. Yeah. I'm not the first one to think about this, of course. I mean, we've known that change is important from the beginning of time, but I'm just saying that it's in this particular instance, it's something that I've noticed, and I think it's worthy of discussion.
Yeah, I agree. I find it interesting what you said about athletes who would do well being on traditional and then going to the Bonnerchuk system. And I found similar things in just like athletes who are on a traditional blocked, kind of non-individualized program, and then they go to like a 3-day rollover where it's more individualized and they get to rest and feel things out. And it seems like rather than just going right to the rollover, I've seen a little bit better than that in the more traditional realm of things.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's dangerous when you see as a coach, when you get results off these, say non-plan changes or whatever, it's dangerous to think, well, oh, it was exactly what I did that led to that change. Well, maybe yes, that was part of it, but maybe it was just the change, you know? And so I just think it's an important question to ask yourself.
Yeah, I agree. I think of that a lot with, I work with swimmers who are very, like Charles Poliquin described, like Thomas the Train Engine, very GABA dominant. And I've actually been surprised at some of them in what I would call, I guess, their lack of need for change in terms of what I had originally expected. And it's blown me away. But then I think of, the more dopamine and acetylcholine. And I just took a DNA test. Apparently, I have a high need for novelty in my genes. So maybe that means I should have been a program hopper more often. And I kind of do. But I that is interesting to me in terms of athletes' genetic predispositions to how often do they need to see different things in their programming.
Totally. And everybody's different. That's another thing that you notice from this. Everybody from this, when you use this Bonnerchuk system strictly and accurately, you'll notice that everybody's reactions are different. They're similar. Some are similar in a lot of ways. It's not that every single athlete is completely unique to every single other athlete. But athletes, there definitely is a range and a continuum there in terms of how athletes respond. And generally speaking, I would say that athletes with more sensitive nervous systems that are either naturally more, at a higher level in terms of their ability to output force, they tend to need more change. They tend to respond to change. They're highly sensitive. They react to changes in training much more acutely than athletes on the other end of the spectrum. And that may be natural, or it may also be where they are on the developmental spectrum, how many years of training that they have behind them. So these are things to really, that's important to understand that. I remember Dan telling me once way back, I think when Donovan was making, I think it was when he was making his comeback after his Achilles problem, he went out and ran 10 flat in a meet. It was totally unexpected. And Dan sent me an email, said, yeah, he hasn't done anything, no more than 6 weeks of general training. Well, there you go. You know, that's, there are cats that are like that. So, I always store these anecdotes and this information and try to put it into a bigger context.
Yeah, I always love those stories where coaching where we almost find things in accident and things we wouldn't expect. It's so useful.
Well, you have to expect them. That's good coaching. It's what you do with it. It's how you react to that information. It's how you interpret it. It's not, you know, and if you're stuck in a very, you know, with a very strong ideological, you know, one perspective, and you believe that everybody should fit into this one model, well, then you may dismiss a very important piece of information that happens to come your way like that. And, you know, on the other hand, you don't want to react to everything either. I mean, you have to have some consistency and, you know, but it's, I think the best coaches are always sort of noticing these trends and things like that and using it to their advantage.
Yeah. That's awesome. Awesome insight. I've seen similar things like that, no doubt. So second question, I need to start getting through my question list here.
Sure.
But it's been awesome information so far. And, the Bondarchuk model, obviously there's a limit to the number of exercises. And I think in traditional trainings, I mean, there's certainly a range, but there's a lot of cases where there's a whole lot of exercises in the program. And so what's your take on, even for those coaches in traditional models, how should we be viewing exercise diversity and then the amount of exercises in the program?
It's a big question, but it's a good question, but it's a big question. So, first of all, there's no limit to the number of exercises that you can put in a Bondarchuk system. What you have to understand, there's a principle there. And the principle goes like this. The more programs and the more exercises and training that you have, the longer it's going to take for an athlete to reach peak condition. Okay. So if you have three programs in there, there's three groups of exercises, there's three, you know, there's triple the stimulus there, it takes time for an athlete to react to all of that. Their, you know, their adaptation, it's just going to slow down because you just simply, you know, you, it's just every time that you get to any one of the stimulus, it's going to be, you know, 3 days down the road as opposed to, or 2 days down the road as opposed to doing it every day. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, So that's the thing. I mean, and the idea in this system, one of the other ideas here is that, which I find really interesting, which is also really separates the Bondarchuk system from sort of some other non-Bondarchuk systems. And that is that when you start to set up the program in a way that's not calendar-based and you are set it up to measure an athlete's response and how quickly they come into peak condition, you find that they're going to come into peak. Typically they come into peak condition a lot sooner because you're in the Bondarchuk system, because he just tends to use only one or two programs. I usually use two or three. He usually uses one or two, although I've seen him use three. When an athlete comes and one of the principles or one of the ideas he has there is the more that you can compress that into any given amount of time, a smaller amount of time, they're going to peak sooner. There's a reality there. You can't do five workouts a day, but you can do two. He's experimented with three and it didn't work, but you can do two. And so the sooner you come into peak condition, the sooner you can go into a rest cycle or maintenance or whatever, and then start another one after that. And the more, which means the more peak conditions you can get in the long term in a given year or a given annual cycle. He doesn't even think about annual cycles. He just looks at these things as repeating these development cycles where you start an athlete on a new program or set of programs and they reach peak condition. That's the end of the development cycle, you have to figure out what to do after that. So I've seen athletes do 6 or 7 a year, and or come into peak 6 or 7 times a year. Therefore, they get huge growth because theoretically, with each, if you do it right, with each new program development cycle, there should be overall growth in the athlete's condition. Okay, so that's the way you look at it. So therefore, if you're using huge amounts of exercises, I mean, you can only do so many exercises. I mean, we use a complex system where we do everything. You can only do so many exercises in a workout. If you could pack it in and stuff a million exercises in there, it's just going to take them longer to reach peak condition because the workouts are going to be that much more difficult. And so, and if you have, you know, if you have 5 training programs as opposed to 2 or 3, it's going to take them, you know, 2 to 3, 4 times longer to reach peak condition, just simply because you don't get around to each stimulus. So here's an example. So when I try to determine how long it takes an athlete to reach peak conditions, I don't look at it in terms of time. I look at it in terms of number of exposures to a program or a workout, a stimulus. Okay. So let's say I've given them 2 different programs. Each program has, let's say it's a thrower and each workout has throws, special exercises, specific exercises, whatever you want to call it. SDE is what we call it. Some global strength abilities and some general strength. Each one, I always sort of follow that format because I like to do a true sessional complex. So if I'm doing that and I have 2 workouts, and they come into peak condition after 24 sessions. Well, they've done each one 12 times. And so we call it touches sometimes. We look at every time that they touch those specific exercises, and it applies to the other ones too, the more general ones, but it's, you know, I'm really concerned about the more specific exercises. Every time they did one of those workouts once, that's one touch. So I would say, okay, that athlete will come into peak condition every 12 sessions. They peaked after 24 sessions because I had 2 programs. If I had 3, it would have been 36, right? So then the next question is, well, why don't you just do 1 and have them peak sooner in 12 sessions, right? Well, I like the variance, and sometimes you can't pack it all in one. I will in the short term, if I have a short period of time I need an athlete to peak in, then I will only give them 1 and 1 program. But if I have the time, I like to beef it up a little bit because I like to expose them to the, you know, you also have to have variation across the board. You have to expose them to a number of, you can't just have them do 1 or 2 exercises, right? So it's this balance of these two things that you have to play with. And that's, to me, very customized periodization.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, that I'm glad you mentioned that there at the end, because I was thinking, and that's something you mentioned on the podcast with Robbie Bork, that it really got the wheels turning. And in my head, I was listening to it on the way to work, and you had mentioned the more peak conditions you get into on the year, the better that is for your performance.
And the more peak conditions you get in any unit of time. The year happens to be the one that we all think about.
Yeah, yeah.
But Bonnerchuk doesn't think of it that way. Okay, Bonnerchuk thinks of it as just playing, I'm just doing one development cycle after another. It's important thing to understand because I think of it in terms of the annual cycle, but he doesn't.
Yeah, especially with things like the Olympics in mind and just long-term career development in general, I'm sure that's probably a good way to go about things. I was thinking, and then you mentioned there at the end, but so I was thinking, well, wouldn't it be the best to just cram a bunch of single workout stimulus in, so you hit peak condition more often than doing a 2 or a 3 workout model where you would take 2 or 3 times as long to hit the peak condition? Just thoughts on that. I hope I'm not rambling with my question there.
No. But I just sort of touched on that. The question is, well, why wouldn't you do that? Well, you do that. Bonnerchuk does it a lot, but You also want, I mean, there's a fair amount of bases you want to touch in training, right? You can't pack it all into one session all the time. So for instance, I may want an athlete to do three or four weights, different weights of hammers. If I'm coaching them, I'm not going to put four weights into one workout. I'll put three in, but I won't put four. Or I could go with three sessions and put a heavy, a comp weight and a light in each session. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Let's say in a program two, I want to hit a pull. I want to hit a push and I want to hit a squat and maybe a lunge. Let's say I'm not going to pack all four of those into one session, right? So I need more programs so I can hit all those targets. So that's why you would go to more programs. Does that make sense? I mean, it's, you know, and if, you know, if for me, I'll use one program if it's like later in the year and, you know, the athletes had a number of peak conditions already in the cycle and I want to get them into form in a shorter period of time. I may only use one, but typically if I can use two or three, I like to use two or three. I find that the strength of the overall reaction is better, stronger when you use more programs. But again, it's the balance. If I use one, they get more peaks and they get more peaks in a shorter time. If I use five, it's a stronger stimulus. It's a stronger, you know, there's more to the program. So the reaction is going to be, you know, healthier, stronger, but it's also going to take me five times longer to reach peak. So I got to find the balance of these two things. And that's all it is. There is no, yes, you do one. Yes, you do three. Yes, you do four. It's what you need based upon, you know, where you're at in the athlete's development of that year, session, whatever, or, you know, in that phase, how far you have to your competitions. I mean, it's a number of things you got to think about.
Yeah. The reason I was trying to, I guess, get more out of that, it really intrigues me because that piece of the Bondarchuk system, I think, at least even speaking in generalities, is kind of applicable to anything. Like if you're a sprint coach, how many kinds of, just generally speaking, how many kinds of sprint workouts are you doing?
Well, exactly. And that's probably, thanks for touching on that. Cause that's another, I mean, I just use the throws as an example in sprints. Well, you're going to have at least three sessions because, you know, I would say in any given development cycle, which is sort of akin to a macro or meso cycle, depending on how you define that word, a collection of microcycles, you know, you're going to want to hit at least two of the primary sprint abilities. You're probably going to want an acceleration session in there. You're probably going to want a max speed and maybe some kind of special or speed endurance, right? So you can't do all those in one session.
Yeah,
so
that'd be rough.
You know, so you need, and then you may want a recovery session. So maybe you may have four or five sessions and it's going to take you, yes, it's going to take you longer to reach peak condition, but that is the nature of sprinting. That's the nature of sprint periodization. You're just sprinters are not going to peak as many times as a thrower will, a hammer thrower could. It's just the nature of the beast. But you take the principle, you take the idea, and you start messing around with it like Stu McMillan did with the example I gave. I forget.
Yeah, doing chambers, I think, was the last one. And I heard that.
Yeah, yeah.
Stu told me about that as well, I think, at a seminar recently.
Yeah. So, you know, that was a brilliant example of how he took some of this Bondarchuk stuff. And, you know, Stu's not an idiot. I like to call him an idiot. I like to think he's an idiot because it's fun. We're buddies. But he's not an idiot. So we had a long, long discussion about that in 2012 over lunch one day. And I could see him just sort of the wheels turning. So he took an experiment and he did it brilliantly. Don't tell him I said that, but he did it brilliantly. And he, I think that's exactly what I'm getting at here. I'm offering people some insight into something that is unique, different. Take what you need, leave the rest. You know, make it work for you. And that's what he did. I thought, and of course, he doesn't tell me about this until like this year. So, you know, and I'm like, why didn't you tell me about that? Because, you know, but anyways, it, you know, he, you know, that's the idea, right? Now, what he did in that particular, and I've talked about, I won't go on too much about, but what he did in that in particular example, he used a lot of variance. He stuck with those 60 meter lengths, but he used a lot of variance, which has opened my eyes to a lot of things. You know, some maybe there is some room within this non-wave loading of volume and intensity, but maybe in variation you can change things a lot to make it work. I didn't really consider it the way he had done it, and it opened my eyes. And then we had another long discussion when I was down in Phoenix earlier this year about what he's doing with his sprint group, and it's absolutely fascinating what he's doing there. I really hope the results go, you know, I'm sure he's doing a good job there, but if you know what he's doing there down there is some pretty interesting stuff. Like I was like, we had dinner one night and he was telling me all about it, and it was, again, it's one of these things where they didn't have a facility for I won't get too into it because I don't want to give away at all, but just because it's you know, people need to dig this stuff up on there. I don't want to give everything away, but I mean, he is playing around with the idea of specificity and using a lot of it in terms of variation in the environment he's putting athletes in and skill development. And I find it fascinating because he's getting some really interesting results out of it. And it just really stimulated a lot of my thinking around how specific do we need to be? What does specificity really mean? Like, what, you know, what do we mean when we're talking about that? And he's kind of like, if you look at, say you're coaching a 100 meter guy. I'm going off on a tangent here, but what the fuck? Let's just do it. So, okay. So let's say you're coaching a 100 meter guy, and you know, you need to, you know, what's the most specific work for a 100 meter guy? Balls out, 100 meter sprinting, maximal velocity sprinting, and let's call that ground zero. Well, but that's very difficult to do because of the impact it has on the athlete and the danger it has with some athletes with injury. I mean, you know, there's reasons why. I mean, we all know that you can't do that kind of work every day, day in and day out. It's got to be managed very, very carefully. So what he's sort of doing is he's dancing around ground zero a lot with a lot of, and using not just volumes and intensities to do it, but he's using this, you know, he's implemented skill acquisition and using that as a variable, and how he manipulates, you know, the qualitative nature of the training to do. And it's, I just find it really fascinating. I think it's pretty cool. You know, it's going to be another year or two before we can sort of look at it, you know, really assess whether it was effective or not, but early results are very, very good. So
that's awesome. Yeah. When I first heard about that and Stu's presentations that I saw him in Chicago in the summer, and it was just first class, and that Dwayne Chambers, I wish I could remember more of it, but it was funny because
did he talk about Dwayne Chambers in Chicago?
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah. I think that's where I heard about it.
He owes me. He owes me.
I think so. I don't
want that on record.
Yeah, I might have to ask him so I don't misquote him here on the show. But I believe it was that. But yeah, I what you were saying before got my train of thought headed in that direction. Like the idea of, you know, not just always doing, like, you wouldn't want to just run 100 meters as fast as you could every single time the whole year. I mean, maybe you could, but I mean the variance or. Or you wouldn't want to cram those three workouts into one day. I mean, you wouldn't want to cram acceleration, max velocity, and special endurance into one day and do that every single day.
But you can barely cram them into 1 week.
Yeah, exactly. But if
you know, I mean, you know,
that got me then thinking. I was like, well, what if you needed to get in peak form real quick? Well, maybe you would want to do something that was more specific and do it more often. I was like, wait, Stu did something like that, I think, with Dwayne Chambers, and then you brought it up, right? You know, similar to what he was doing.
Yeah. So people ask me all the time, how do you implement this into a sprint paradigm? And I said, well, it's really simple. I mean, all you do is you have a choice. If you want to peak more often and do shorter cycles, you can do that with the sprints, but you're going to have to limit the number of sprint abilities that you target. So you may only be able to do acceleration, max velocity or acceleration and special endurance or something in one development cycle. That's nothing wrong with that. Just in the next cycle, you're gonna have to plan that out in a way that you do hit all the bases that you need to hit in the long term. Or you target more of those abilities, say three or four of them in a development cycle, but that's gonna necessitate more workouts, a longer micro, and it means you're gonna hit peak condition fewer times in the year. I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm saying that the first example is an option we haven't really previously, I don't think too many coaches have previously considered. And I'm just throwing it out there as think about it. But if you're gonna do that, you better, you're gonna have to be on your toes, because it is a bit different, and managing that kind of intensity and load that regular is going to be, it can be absolutely done. I think it can, but you're gonna have to consider the volumes and the intensities you're working at. And then again, you factor into this idea of dancing around this ground zero with skill acquisition and that Stu's doing. And I absolutely think it's a whole new area. It's a whole new path that we're going down, which I think, and maybe it's shit. Maybe it's not going to work. I don't know, but I know Stu's not an idiot, so he's if anybody's going to be able to implement it, it's him. And I think it's just, to me, it's just all very exciting. I'm a methodology geek, and to me it's all very exciting. A lot of people think, well, it's all bullshit, but that's fine. I to me it's awesome. I was really came away from my trip in Phoenix quite excited about all this.
Yeah, it'll be awesome to see where that goes. I think that injury or risk of injury is probably one of the biggest things that keeps people from experimenting with that more often, with throws versus sprints. You don't want to blow something up doing that. Probably they're higher risk of doing that, maybe might factor into mm-hmm. it, you think?
Well, you just apply the same good coaching practice that any decent sprint coach is going to apply. He's going to manage volumes. He's going to manage intensities. He or she are going to, you're going to have some form of regular therapy in there. You're going to make sure that the athlete is not spiking intensities, because we know that's one sure way to get somebody hurt. You're going to be specific all year round, because that's another way that you manage injury. Okay. So, all the same general rules apply. You're just going to, you just be sane in how you implement it.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, no doubt. So I'm going to bump a question up, because I think it'll fit pretty well into what we were just talking about a little bit. And what's your take? Well, I'll ask this first. And it seems to me like the Bondarchuk system is based, and this is just, I didn't get this from anywhere but my own brain, so who knows if it's even close to being right. But it seems to me that the Bondarchuk system is based more on like neural adaptation, like adaptation of the motor pattern, since there's not like delayed transformation or hypertrophy phase or whatever. And so more than in terms of skill acquisition or in terms of skill acquisition and motor learning, more so than like the muscular and hormonal adaptations and planned overshoots and those types of things. What's your thought on that way of adapting in general in speed and power activity?
Okay, that's a really good question. Okay, so here's the thing you have to understand. When you read any of his books, particularly the ones on periodization, and he has those little intros. It was the first thing that we wrote, that he had me write when I helped him write the first book when he came to North America, which never saw the light of day, incidentally. But anyways, but it's a good read. It's all built around this idea of peak condition. Okay. Athlete form. And what you have to understand, let me back up. It's all based around this idea of athlete form, peak condition. And that's represented in those graphs, how an athlete responds to training. It's not unique to Bondarchuk in terms of, an athlete you want an athlete to reach peak condition. That's what all training is about. You want them to adapt and come into form. But he's very specific about his definition of peak condition. It is technical, hormonal, it's everything together. It's the complete package of how it's emotional, it's psychological peak. It's an athlete reaches form, they're driving on all, they're firing on all 12 cylinders maximally, okay? So that's kind of how I look at it. It's not, you know, and this is one of the reasons why he's big into the complex methodology that all of these, you know, all four exercise classifications have to be present in pretty much all the time, unless you're in a rest cycle or something like that, okay? Because it's you don't want them to peak independently of one another, because we know that there's when there's a harmony in terms of you know, the development of these, of all these abilities. And let's face it, how hard is it to try to peak them in stages? Like, it's very difficult, okay? Like, and why would you want to do that? You want the athlete to peak in, you know, number one priority is to have the peak in the specific exercise at the right time, but you also want them to peak in all these other abilities. They all are together. They all should peak together, and you train them. That's why we train them all together, because the sum, the peak sum is going to be, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Okay. So when they all peak together, there's a higher output than there would be if you peak them individually. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I wouldn't say it's not based on neural constructs either way. Yes, you use exercise as your main mode of, it's not the, he doesn't only use exercise in terms of his main, as his main tool in creating adaptation. It's just that you have such a wide variance when you're talking about exercise than you do if you're talking about, you know, wave loading or manipulating volume and intensity. Because, and I've said this many, many times before, because if you get outside of the specific ranges of a particular ability, then you're not training that ability anymore. And so, you know, yes, you can have variation within that range. I'm not talking about changing it within the cycle. I'm saying what is available to you from on a cycle to cycle basis. Then it, you know, you just can't throw a medicine ball for explosive strength, you know, 10 sets of 10. It's because it's useless after the first two sets, okay? It's probably useless after the first six or seven reps of each set, right? So you know, that's what I'm talking about here. So what do you have? You've got density and you've got variation in exercise to sort of manage everything, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I part of the reason I kind of had thought about that question too is like how different systems have been set to adapt at different times. But then with the Bondarchuk system, you have so few types of workouts itself, it would make sense that the leg, and it's not like there's delayed overtraining or anything like with like a strength phase. So it's a lot more simple in them coming up together, which that makes sense to me. Or I think that would be
the
case.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, okay, so in the, you know, it, one of the other things too, when you're using Bondarchuk system is that it's kind of like what Charlie used to say about, you know, his training, is that you never want the athlete to get too far away from competitive readiness. It's a little bit different with the Bondarchuk and some of the reactions, like an athlete that is a number two, where they drop in form before they come up. They will get a fair ways away. But generally speaking, in terms of loading, you're not going to load them so hard in this system that you crush them. And not that you'd ever want to do that anyways, but you know, you never, like, you have to find that sweet spot in load that is, you know, that produces the reaction that you want, but is not so hard, that is not so overloaded that they don't come into peak condition in a reliable fashion. They don't follow You know, like, I mean, let's face it, if you gave an athlete four or five sessions and each one of them was a killer, killer overloaded session, well, they're not going to peak in 12 sessions, right? They're going to peak in way longer. So, you know, that's just, so there are brackets here that you need to sort of stay within, but you got a fair amount of leeway within those brackets. And that's, you know, the system does take a bit of experimentation. So you learn what those are. I mean, with the hammer throwers, I have a very clear idea what those ranges are, and the odd athlete will come along that you can't, you know, you've got to sort of be very, very close to one end of the range because that's their particular makeup. They either don't respond to a lot of work, like when I coached Sultana Frizzell, she was like that, or they do respond to a lot of work, like Sophie Hitchin did when I coached her. It's just the nature of the beast. With Sophie, I was up, you know, a heavier amount of throws, a little bit more in the overall loading. With Sultana, it was much less because she couldn't tolerate any more than whatever we were at, you know, a dozen throws a session, 16 throws a session, something like, whereas Sophie was up around 20, 22, that kind of thing.
Sure. What's your, and just kind of maybe a little bit nuts and bolts and something that's interesting to me, and I think I've heard you mention this on other podcasts, is that the Bondarchuk system, it's simple at its core, but actually implementing it can be, you know, very complex. It obviously takes a lot of time and experience, but how do you kind of go about the process of learning those athletes in terms of if they handle high or low loads? How many cycles does it take you to get there? Or do you kind of look at history, or what's the process there within the scope of the system?
You look at everything. So I just started in China with an athlete that was coached by John Godina before. You know, first thing I said to her is, I need to see everything you've ever done. So I didn't get all the information out of her that I needed, but I got, you know, her weight program, that I need to take all of that into consideration. You basically start with something that seems rational based on experience. And then you know, over the next few cycles, you try to get a handle on where they're at. That's why. And of course, I started this right in the middle, right before the competitive season, which is the absolute worst time to start this. But even so, I got a very strong reaction out of her in our first cycle, and she actually threw quite well in training. So I was very happy with it. I think I have her dialed in pretty close after one cycle, but it could take up to a year. I mean, I've heard Bondarchuk say it takes a year, year and a half with some athletes to figure out, because they could be all over the place. There's a lot of factors. You know, the athlete's natural adaptability is one. The lifestyle factors and their ability to train full time and things like that. Like the greatest I've ever seen was Sophie Hitchin. Sophie Hitchin was a bloody, was the most committed, professional, dedicated athlete that I've ever worked with. And so it was so easy with her. I got responses, clear responses out of her right out of the gate, because I know that Sophie is doing everything she can off track to be the best athlete that she could. Even Gary Reed, probably the number two on my list there, is an athlete I coached here. He's phenomenal that way, but I Sophie is the best I've ever seen. So that's really, really important that they, because let's face it, if they're going out whoring every weekend, I'm not trying to be funny with that example, but they're out, it's going to affect the reaction. If they're not eating well, if they have some kind of emotional crisis that you can't avoid, it's going to affect the reaction. So you have to, you know, take that into account. Right. But again, you know, the more on board the athlete is, the easier it is to find that groove really quickly.
Yeah. So you'd say the Bondarchuk system would probably work a lot better for post-collegiate professional athletes than a college level, where obviously they're getting a lot of different stressors, like finals weeks and those types of things.
I mean, this system, it all depends on how you want to implement it. It could be your absolute best friend in the NCAA system, especially through something like exam period, or where you, you know, where you, you have things coming at you at all, you know, having said what I just said about Sophie, the other thing with it too, is that you can, because you can play with density so much easier with this system, you, it's all in how you set up those sessions. So if you set up session, I get asked this question all the time, and this really applies to people that are sort of working as supplementary coaches within another sport environment. So say you're you're a speed power coach working with a professional football player or something. You can't control what they're doing on the field. So you're going to give them sessions that are, you know, your three sessions are going to be geared towards different environments that they're going to find themselves in. Pre-field work, post-field work, day off. You know, you're going to set up your sessions based on that, and they're going to roll them over based upon how they, just like Dan does in his rollover sprint cycle, you're going to roll those over based upon how the athlete, you know, can fit it into their schedule and based on how much rest they need. Is it perfectly ideal to what I can do? No, but that would be a really good way to do it. So an NCAA coach may, again, tap into the ideas and the principles of the Bondarchuk system and use that to their advantage. Not that they're going to try to replicate the system, because maybe they aren't in the environment that they can do that. But, you know, again, you want to minimize the change within a session, and from session to session, roll them over and have some kind of measurable that you can rely upon. And in the throws, it's very easy because you can measure throwing every day. If you're a speed power coach working with a football player, it's going to have to be something different because you can't measure football. You can't measure, hey, are you a better football player today than you were yesterday? Well, no, it's almost impossible. It is impossible to measure. Let's not kid ourselves. So you might use bar velocity.
Yeah.
You might use, you know, but again, you know, make sure that they're as, and you'll learn this over time, make sure that those are as specific as they can be and as reliable, that there's a connection between that measurable and being a football player. Is it going to be an absolute connection? You're probably never going to find it, but you can get closer with some exercises than you can with another. And how do you find that out? You throw it against the wall to see what sticks. Simple as that.
Yeah, I know you had mentioned that bar speed has gone pretty close with the throwing distance as well. Like if the bar speeds are up, the throws are usually up too. So that was something that at least be a loose way of doing.
I am dying to meet Brian Mann, because his stuff, that's another big, you know, when I started reading his stuff, I was like, geez, this is perfect for the Bondarchuk system, but we use it differently. Rather than using bar velocity to stay within a zone, we just use it. I just measure bar velocity the way I do throws. I just use it with every workout that they do, Olympics or whatever exercise, bench press, whatever. and I track that. And the first time I did it, I got a near identical curve to the throwing results that I was getting. Near identical. I mean, they were it was stunning. I was like, holy shit. Well, what does this tell you? So, and I would love to sit down with that guy and have a big discussion about this, because I think we have a lot to offer each other. I love his work, and I just find it's fascinating stuff, and it so works well with the Bondarchuk system because what that does for me is it gives me another measurable, because, and this sort of speaks to your point here, because I know that, and I've repeated this, okay? So I've repeated this, and I just did it in China with my discus source. Same thing. When she peaked in throw, she peaked in bar speed, okay? So if I know that, there's a correlation between bar speed and the specific measurable I'm having, well, what if I can't throw one day? What if I'm in a situation where I can't throw at all in a cycle? I can rely on bar speed to know if I'm in peak condition because I know there's a correlation there. But the key is I've established that correlation over time with different athletes, with different exercises, with different, you know, and so it's, that's powerful. That opens up a whole realm of possibilities for people that that you know sort of get that. And I think you know, that's another very exciting world that I've sort of fell into in the last few years. And Nick Garcia's, you know, him and I go back and forth a lot with the information on this and how we, you know, how we use bar speeds. I think I'm not a gimmick guy. Okay. Not at all. Not a fad guy at all. I used to be, you know, I wouldn't say I used to be. I say, you know, I tested it. I used to test everything. I'm pretty set in my ways now. I know what's going to work, what's not going to work. But if something comes along that I think adds value, the beauty of this Bonnerchuk system is because I have a specific measurable all the time, I can throw things in and find out if they're effective or not. Because if they're not effective, I'm not going to get the result in the specific measurable. The throwing distances aren't going to be what I want them to be. So if I find something and it fits in and I can get a measurable that's, you know, I also, then I'm going to use it. Then I'm going to use it because it's just more information to back up what I'm getting on the field. I've also used back heaves, you know, just simple back. You don't need to always use bar speed. I think in the hammer or in the throws, bar speed, there's a big correlation to it, believe it or not. But also back heaves, I've used that, you know, didn't find quite the correlation with that I did with bar speeds, but it's still the general trend is when the distances, Dan has said this before, when the distances go up, so do the specific measurables. So you can use those things, but you just, I guess my last point I want to make about this is just make sure that you have that correlation between the two, because a lot of times we're all very guilty with this. We assume that there's a correlation between them, when there may in fact not be as much as we think there is. Find out, get a specific measure, as specific as you can, and rely on them and, you know, measure everything against that.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And that definitely lends to what you said about how the multiple systems adapting at the same time with the bar speed and the throws. And then, when you were saying that, I was kind of thinking about like, well, what would the bar, would that be the same for sprints and jumps and how would it be different? Or maybe some of those other tests, KPIs would be different. And yeah, I think that's all really good information. Good things to think about for our different.
Well, remember groups. Something too is, you know, I found the closest correlation in bar speed with exercises that are somewhat mimic the form of the hammer throw. So Olympic pulls kind of do that. If you look at the hammer throw and the ball passes the low point, essentially what an athlete is doing is their body is going into full extension. My hammer friends are going to criticize me for this, but you know, it's basically a pull. But it isn't a pull. You don't want to pull. You don't want to pull in the technique. But the pattern is fairly similar. I don't think there's a colossal amounts of transfer there. But they are. But you know what I'm seeing in the bar speeds and that correlation. Okay. I've also with my discus thrower, I've found the same thing. But it's with the pulls, but also the bench press, which is relatively specific to discus because it's that, you know, it's the pectoral girdle and. So, you know, find, you know, just something that's food for thought there. Find yeah. What measurables are going to, you know, relate.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad you elaborated on that because I'd heard that before you say that. And that gives me more specificity. I'm sure everyone listening at home as well. So that's all the time I have for today, Derek. But thanks for being on, man. I learned so much and really expanded my thoughts on the Bonnerchuk systems. All right, that does it for another episode. Thanks for tuning in with us this week. We enjoy having you listening to the show. If you enjoyed it, please leave a rating or a review on your listening platform of choice. We'd really appreciate that. Also, don't forget to visit our sponsors at simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology such as the K-Box, RunScribe, SpeedMat, PowerDot, which I've been using lately, enjoying that, the FreeLap timing system, and much more. We'll see you guys next week. Have a good one.